Well, I think, Bob, really, to be honest with you...
Sure, I want you to
I wanted to always play it down. I still like playing it down.
Yes, sir.
Because I don't want to create a panic.
I think he did not understand the American public. We know from history, when the public is told the truth, they organize, we have a problem, we're going to step up. And Trump thought, oh, well, they'll panic.
Hello, and welcome to The Reason Podcast. I'm Catherine Mangue Ward, filling in for Matt Welsh, who is hiking the Appalachian Trail, and I am joined today by my usual compatriot, Nick Gillespie, as well as two special guest stars, Zach Weissmuller and Eric Boehm. Hi, guys.
Hey, Catherine.
How you doing, Catherine?
Hi.
We have obviously killed Peter Suderman and buried his body. More on that later. But first, you just heard Bob Woodward. He was on 60 Minutes this weekend playing a tape from one of the 18 conversations he had with President Donald Trump over the course of the reporting for his new book titled, aptly enough, Rage. When the book dropped this week, many people focused on the timeline the book provided for what Donald Trump knew about the novel coronavirus emanating from Wuhan, China, and when he knew it. The interviews go back to January, in which Trump says it's deadly stuff and notes that he is that the disease will be even worse than a strenuous flu. As the spring goes on, though, he continues to reassure the public and play down the seriousness. So on this Monday morning at the Reason Roundtable, I want to start with a light question for Nick Gillespie,
sure,
which is, when is it acceptable for leaders to tell the public a noble lie?
Yeah, I'm, you know, the Dr. Zaius in me wants to say always. We should never know the truth, and that there should be some wise orangutans who know and keep it to themselves. And then destroy all the evidence once Charlton Heston finds it in a cave. But more realistically, I find this kind of stuff deeply disturbing for all sorts of reasons. And noble lies are lies, but they're not noble. So I think the way Trump is talking here makes a certain amount of sense. I don't think it actually adds anything to our understanding of his character, certainly. And ultimately, I'm not sure how much effect any of this had on policy, per se. You know, this is an adjacent but separate issue. This seems to be, you know, one more attempt to finally reveal just how evil and awful Donald Trump is to people who have already decided not to vote for him sometime in mid-2015.
That is actually kind of a recurring theme on this podcast lately, is the question of when the thing will be revealed that will turn the tides against Donald Trump and the sort of eternal hope of the press. We had one of these last week. I don't even remember it anymore. Do you guys? It was something in The Atlantic, I think. But this here is the new one. Eric, you have covered some of the many bureaucratic failures around COVID-19. But what do you think is the real upshot of, you know, say there is a hypothetical in which Donald Trump had come out in January or February and said, this is serious business, just bully pulpit alone. Does that make a difference?
I think it probably makes a little bit of a difference for how some people reacted to it. I think the bigger story here is not necessarily that hypothetical, because I don't know, you could play that hypothetical however you want. I think the bigger thing here is that for a certain subset of the electorate, not to just immediately make it all about politics, but a certain, I think, pretty strong argument for Donald Trump's candidacy and presidency and re-election pitch is that he tells it like it is, right? Oh, he's not a normal politician. He speaks the truth. He says what's on his mind. And this really cuts against that. If you're somebody who likes Donald Trump because he's not a politician, well, wait a minute. His explanation here is that, oh, I was behaving like a politician. I was telling a noble lie. I was doing the thing that all the evil elites do when they keep you in the dark about something. And so I think that, like, that speaks, I agree with Nick to some extent. I think, you know, Donald Trump lies all the time. That's part of his character. We know that. I don't think that's telling anybody anything new. But this sort of idea that, like, oh, I knew these things, but I couldn't tell you, even though I'm an open book on every other subject all the time. I don't know. It suggests that either he's lying in some way, but I mean, it suggests that either he is He's coming up with some sort of post hoc justification for what he now realizes was a mistaken few weeks or months worth of COVID strategy, or it means that he's not the guy that you think he is if he's somebody who just tells it like it is.
Zach, you've done some reporting on all the other powerful people and institutions who screwed up early response to coronavirus and misjudged its severity. Donald Trump wasn't alone in getting this wrong, right?
No, I mean, it actually started with the WHO, which I think was slow to sound the alarm for similar reasons, you know, not, you know, spooking the markets, in this case, protecting China's market and travel industry. And then our own CDC mm-hmm. and Surgeon General regarding mask usage, we were, you know, given a kind of dueling reasons why masks didn't work, and it seemed to be more about protecting supply than whether or not they're effective in, you know, slowing transmission of the virus. And so I'm just sick of the so-called noble lies. I think that it's based on just flawed mid-20th century thinking. You know, information is just moving so quickly now that the whole idea of this paternalistic lie and we are going to control the flow of information in a productive way, it just doesn't work because the information gets out there so quickly now. And so you're not going to control it or suppress it for long. And the more our politicians are thwarting that flow of information at this point, whatever the rationale, the worse off we are because it gives us less and less time for some sort of organic bottom-up adaptation to the circumstances. And in that sense, I think Woodward is totally correct that the advantage of knowing, having a more accurate assessment of the threat here is that not that our politicians are going to swoop into action and save us, because that's clearly not going to happen, but at least, you know, as a society and as a people, we can start sooner to adapt to this new reality. So I think it is debatable how much of an effect this had on policy versus, you know, what another potential president would have done. But I do think his actions here were just totally disgraceful.
Yeah, that particular clip was a little bit of weird Bob Woodward giving me the warm fuzzies, which is not exactly what he's famous for. But, you know, him sort of saying, listen, the loss here was that Americans didn't get a chance to help themselves. I thought was a pretty good point. But isn't this week's entire news cycle actually a very mid-20th century thing? I mean, it's exclusive interviews with a extremely established geriatric journalist who sat on important information, arguably, for months in order to publish it on a dead tree book and then do a publicity blitz centered around 60 Minutes. Like, what year is it? What are we doing? Why does this version of the news cycle still exist alongside that high velocity thing that you're describing, Zach?
I am not really sure. I guess just a certain demo still enjoys 60 Minutes and reading Bob Woodward books. It's not my thing necessarily. I mean, I think a lot of people who were on to this early were, you know, the dreaded extremely online folk who were watching that crazy flow of information. And it can absolutely drive you nuts. And, you know, it's fertile ground for conspiracy theories. But, the upshot of that is that we are able to quickly undermine the bullshit that's coming out of our elected officials' mouths and the public health officials' mouths, and at least try to figure out, you know, a way to muddle our way through it.
Nick, do you think it matters? Is the question, what did Bob Woodward know and when did he know it? Like, is that one we should be asking?
There was an attempt to kind of attack Woodward, mostly from the right, but also from kind of like the center and even the left, that he was as guilty as Trump in killing untold millions by not immediately rushing to print the minute he knew that Trump knew, you know, it was more serious than he let on publicly. And, you know, I don't find that a compelling argument. And I think, you know, the larger issue here to pull it out of partisan politics, and this is, I think it's a really serious issue that we're going through a phase where we're shifting fully into a kind of postmodern world where truth is you know, a truth can, there is an objective truth out there with a small o and a small t, and we're struggling towards it, but it really is not always clear cut. And even, you know, exactly what the Wuhan flu was and how best to deal with it was not, it's still not exactly clear. And so we live in a, I mean, you know, and Catherine, in past podcasts, we've talked about this as a kind of Neal Stephenson universe. There is just so much information and so many competing claims to information and how you should act in response to that information. It's both a time of immense kind of liberation, epistemological liberation, but it's also, you know, it creates the world we live in. And so, you know, I don't think Bob Woodward is guilty of anything, you know, ethical, you know, a bad ethical lapse. But this is a world we would be best to leave behind once and for all. It's, I mean, it's 2020 and we're still, like you were saying, I mean, we're acting as if it's 1960 or something, you know, enough already.
I was definitely taking little micro naps between words during that 60 minute segment. Like, I don't know if you guys were like slowly blacking out as the thing was going on, but definitely a pace from a different time. I mean, this is, Nick, I think you raise an interesting point, and I'd be interested to hear from Eric and Zach about this too. Are we someday gonna actually know what happened and what could have happened with coronavirus? I mean, I'm starting to get the feeling that even if at some point someone is able after the fact to do the science and answer a bunch of questions, we're not, the partisan narrative will already be split. Everyone will already have picked their side. Eric, like, are we going to get to a consensus at the end of this, or do we just always have two stories forever?
Yeah, I mean, I saw this movie a couple weeks ago where you can go backwards in time. So maybe we can just do that. We can rewind.
You're
things
talking
to
about
like
the temporal
pacer.
I think we talked about Tenet last week.
Yeah, I know. So, you guys spent a lot of time on that.
I wish I could go back in time to avoid seeing that movie.
It was a callback. But, it was a callback. Yes. You get it. You get it.
Eric's a fan as well pacer. As a participant.
A little bit of both. The whole counterfactual idea of like, oh, if only the president had said different things on February 28th or on March 15th, we would be in a different universe. Like, I mean, yes, to some extent, that's probably true. On the other hand, it's a global pandemic. It has hit countries that were well prepared for it. It has hit countries that were not well prepared for it. It has, there's, you know, you can measure the effectiveness of different government responses or, you know, sort of bottom up individual responses in all different ways. This was going to be bad news for the world. I think the one thing that's definitely true, or the one thing that I at least believe is true, is that we would have been marginally better off if the president had handled things slightly better in those first early weeks in his news conferences, even if he had just taken the threat seriously enough, just sort of conveyed the seriousness of it instead of speculating about random miracle cures that might drop out of heaven, right? Like, I think if there was just a slightly more competent federal response, I think we would have seen a marginally better outcome. But I don't think the worldview out there that the left has, that like, oh, if only our guy was in charge, or if only somebody who wasn't President Trump was in charge, we would have avoided this whole thing. You know, I don't know. That's not true either. So, you know, the difference here is a marginal one, but that margin is maybe thousands of lives. So it's certainly something worth debating.
I don't think we're going to come to a consensus on many of the big issues. I mean, as a society, I do hope that there can be just some baseline things that we might start to converge on, like our elected officials should not intentionally bullshit us. Like, that seems like, I know that's a high bar, but
I admire that you're dreaming big.
If only, yeah. Zach.
Yeah. And I mean, the other, you know, debate that is going to have to be hashed out in the coming years is about the effectiveness of the stay at home orders, because that has been, you know, hugely consequential on our economy, on our way of life, on our civic culture. And there's a lot of debate going on about, you know, this was a new way to approach this problem that had not really ever been tried before. It was pioneered here in California, where I am. And all this stuff, the data around it is so confusing. There's so many contradictory studies and graphs you can point to. And I'm hoping that policies like this are studied seriously, you know, travel bans, the CDC's policy of deciding what tests can be released and not. I mean, there needs to be like some sort of comprehensive look at this response, you know, some sort of commission to look at this or something, maybe in the next administration, just to get to the bottom of a lot of these questions, because I don't think we're going to reach a consensus on like how bad was it versus, you know, other pandemics in the past. But some of these policy questions, like we have to at least, you know, figure out, are we going to do this again, really, if something like this?
Yeah, and I think
again,
that's something that I wrote several times in the beginning of this whole mess, was that really the obligation of public officials here was to convey accurate information to the public and then let the public, you know, judge it. So let every individual that makes up the public, you know, judge their own levels of risk, let people respond appropriately as they see fit. And that was going to be enough of an economic hit anyway, right? Like the shutdowns in many ways came even after people were already staying home, it looks like. So, I mean, it was really this sort of individually driven response that was always going to be the only thing you could do, because you can't realistically enforce a nationwide shutdown or whatever it is some people wish the president had ordered from the beginning. But all you have to do is give accurate information, and not just the president, but also a lot of state leaders failed to do that. They either overstepped, they either tried to go beyond just that basic obligation, or they failed even at that basic obligation.
I do want to kind of underscore, though, that, you know, the information, it's, you know, this is something mid-century approach is that, well, these guys knew the truth and they were hiding it from us. I think it's actually more complicated than that. It's, you know, nobody had really good information. There are certain places where the WHO, for instance, was clearly bending to the will of the Chinese government and whatnot. But this is I find it both, you know, liberating and kind of frightening. Like, what happens when reality really is up for grabs in a way that we did not acknowledge or understand, you know, 50 or 75 years ago? So it gets more complicated than that. And the one thing I think we would probably all agree on is that when this stuff gets politicized, as it is going to be, you know, it just gets worse and worse.
Yeah. And I would agree that there was a lot of uncertainty, especially right at the beginning. And that's part of my problem with it, is that the uncertainty never seems to be conveyed. You never hear the words, you know, it's never hedged. You never hear, we're not sure, this might work, this might not work, you should probably do this. Just more honesty about that level of uncertainty. And as, you know, people who, we talk about media literacy a lot, there also has to be, you know, we can't look to politicians as these end-all, be-all authoritative sources. We have to accept that, you know, they don't have perfect knowledge, and they need to convey that as well, instead of posing as these authoritative, you know, this is the truth and this is how you need to act. That All I'm asking for is honesty about what they do and do not.
I do also think that this is part of the Woodward book tour narrative, but I think it's, you know, he sort of has said Trump obviously knew that this was a big deal, and he chose not to say it, and then he chose not to say it, and then he chose not to say it, and then he said, I solved the problem, you're welcome. There is another interpretation of events, which is that, you know, in each of the 2 or 3 week spans between when Trump and Woodward talked, the entire world changed a bunch of times. And I think we did all experience that, you know, in January versus in February versus in March, we all had very different risk assessments. We did this exercise where we went back and listened to our early podcasts from COVID and assessed our own records, and, you know, they weren't great. But I think this is a great example of when there is ambiguity, people are going to choose the narrative that suits their political interests. And if we're looking to politicians to help us figure out the truth, we're not going to get that. We're going to get the narrative that suits their political interests.
Yeah, I think just Eric, real quick. I think that's exactly right, and I think things changed so quickly over the course of those first. I don't even know when it was. What was it? Late February to mid May. Everything seemed like it changed on a weekly basis. I think that's totally a fair point in defense of the president. I think just to go back to something Zach said, that I think the sort of certainty setting or expectation setting was really important at the beginning of this. And I think that's one thing where you can say the White House in general definitely got it wrong, or the federal government in general. This is not just Trump. This is also the CDC and other elements of the federal government. But I think maybe the best example of that from Trump himself is when he was talking in March about reopening everything by Easter, right? And that was, even at the time he said it, everybody was kind of like, oh, that seems premature. In retrospect, we now know there was no way that that was going to happen. And it wasn't even his, decision to do that. But, I think you see in that moment, you see the thing that Woodward has identified here, which is the fact that the president wanted to be the positive guy, right? He was already looking ahead to when the country's coming out of it, and he wanted to surf that wave as the country was coming out of it. But in doing that, the problem is, I think he set the expectations too low for the American people. Instead of saying, hey, guys, this is going to be really tough. This is going to be 6 tough months. People are going to die. People are going to lose their jobs. We're going to get through it, but you just have to be prepared to buckle in. He was saying, 3 weeks from now, it'll be fine. Like, everybody go buy some beans and we'll get through 3 weeks and it'll be fine. It was obvious from the beginning it wasn't going to be a 3-week ordeal. And I think that sort of expectation setting is where, again, the president specifically, but really the federal government as a whole kind of failed.
I like that call back to the Goya product placements there. Thank That's you right. for that, Eric.
Are we still upset about Goya?
I don't know. I think we moved. There's so many other things to be upset about.
I just try and put beans in every mailbox I see, so that they're heavier when they come to be kidnapped by the producers of Cuties.
Do you remember the mailbox controversy? What was that? Was that 6 months ago or that was, 3 days ago?
That was 10 years ago. It was 10 years
Benjamin
ago.
Benjamin Franklin was Postmaster General or something.
There were lots of other revelations in the Woodward book. I don't want to dwell on just the coronavirus stuff. If y'all want to talk about anything else in there, including perhaps it seems like we almost maybe experienced nuclear war. Eric, endless war forever ended by a nuclear annihilation.
It's one way to end endless wars is just the end of humanity, right? No more wars. We win.
Right. That's true. Maybe this is what Trump meant when he said he was going to finally stop these endless wars. Eric and Zach, you've both been doing kind of some reporting and thinking about the promise to end endless wars, maybe in that second term, maybe. Just very briefly, like, I'm interested in y'all handicapping to the extent that you can. Obviously, that claim that Trump has gotten us out of our many conflicts is basically false. Do you think a second term Trump, though, might make good on some of those campaign pledges?
I'm not optimistic about that. He talks a big game, and yes, he is moving some troops out of Iraq. He has brokered this deal with the Taliban in Afghanistan, which will not actually be executed until, after the election. And it's been less so of a withdrawal type strategy and more so of just a repositioning troops in different places, different emphasis. For instance, just look at Iran, pulling out of the Iran deal and kind of that was a step backwards in my mind in terms of trying to figure out a way to step back from the Middle East, because in order to do that, we are going to need to somehow eventually normalize relations with that country. But Trump has no interest in that. And, to the extent that he does have those impulses, non-interventionist impulses, and has, shifted the conversation, particularly in the Republican Party, that's been a good thing. He's still fighting an uphill battle against his own party, as well as an increasing faction in the Democratic Party. And he just doesn't seem to have made it a priority to actually figure out how to fight those battles. It's it's not going to be easy to unwind, you know, our foreign policy and go against the consensus that exists there in DC. It's going to take somebody who, you know, A, really deeply cares about it, and B, has some sort of strategy about how to do it and surrounds himself with the type of advisors who enable him to do it. And I just haven't seen any of that from Trump so far. So no, wouldn't be particularly optimistic that a second term would move the needle in that direction.
Yeah, I think Trump's heart is in the right place on all of this. He's certainly been the least pro-war president that we've had in a long time. And so all of that is good.
He's anti-war.
Right. I think what Zach said at the end there, though, is exactly the problem. It's that is, you know, Trump doesn't, again, his heart's in the right place, and I respect that, and credit where credit's due for not getting us involved in further wars, and credit where credit's due for starting to unwind Iraq and Afghanistan, which are complicated, difficult situations that even a president who understood all of the sort of DC and military industrial complex shenanigans that go on and had sort of an experience level that Trump does not have and had an attention span that Trump does not have, you know, any other president would struggle to do those things too. But I think it ultimately does come down to that. It's that, like, even if Trump really did deeply care about this, I think he does, but I don't think it's number one on his list. But even if he really did, he would struggle because of the sort of establishment, the thing that's built up there around the Pentagon, around the way the military operates. So I don't know. I guess he's doing his best. This is one area where I would certainly give him as close to full marks as possible for his first 4 years. Although I do wish he could do more. I do wish he would just put his foot down and say, no, all the troops are coming home. But like Zach, I'm somewhat pessimistic that that actually happens.
Nick, I want to switch to a totally unrelated topic, which is the Oscars.
Yeah.
This was the other news story that really caught my attention this week. I think it got some attention, but it's also going to be a slow burn. So we are now switching to maybe, let's call it, like, quota culture, partially as a response, a prophylactic response to cancel culture. So the story is, in 2015, the Oscars had an all-white slate of acting nominees, which did not go over super well in some quarters. And for the last several years, the powers that be, the Academy, have been trying to figure out what to do about that screw up, essentially. And what they have come up with, which they announced this week, is that in order to qualify for Best Picture in 2024, filmmakers will have to file paperwork related to diversity and show that they have met some subset of a large list of standards.
I hope those forms are available online, because we know they're never going to be delivered.
It's bold just to assume that movies will still exist in 2024.
Yeah. Right. So this is first of all, like, the Oscars are delayed, movie theaters are closed, so, like, definitely now is the time to impose a bunch of new requirements on filmmakers. Again, these technically don't kick in until 2024, so I guess there's that. One set of standards requires additional diversity in front of the camera. Your storylines have to be about people of color or other minorities. Your actors and actresses can be a certain, you know, must be a certain percentage of these same groups. Other standards lean more toward behind the scenes and back office and audience diversity.
That would be great to be able to show that, you know, my movie was watched by 30% of the audience seemed identified as African American or something.
Right. And then they've said that they will be enforcing these standards.
Guaranteed to get that Oscar nomination.
Right.
Now they'll find a way to screw Tyler Perry somehow, which is
the
which
man's a
goes
genius.
To,
let's be clear. Let's be honest.
I absolutely think so. And, you know, this is hastening, and again, you know, kind of this idea that we're shifting into a different mode. Have the Oscars ever mattered less? You know, and we're going to talk about sports leagues too. These are all lumbering institutions of high points of the American century that are fading from relevance. We live in a world where there is so much great, you know, film, movie, online storytelling, novels, everything is just proliferating immensely, and there's just a plenitude of great stuff. And these are the operations of, you know, it's like, you know, it reminds me of years ago, we did a documentary about a research museum of East Germany during the collapse of the Berlin Wall. And one of the details at this museum, which is based in Los Angeles of all places, but when the Berlin Wall collapsed, guards who were charged with, you know, either shooting people if they crossed the borders illegally or not, as, you know, massive numbers of people, tens of thousands of people every day were just going back and forth, some of the guards still insisted on, you know, stopping people and getting the information and having them fill out the cards that were supposed to be the official records of who went from East Berlin to West Berlin. This is what the Academy is doing. And this is, you know, it's kind of understandable because this is a world, you know, of limousine liberals, the people who were mocked by South Park so effectively, you know, a decade or more ago. You know, this is how they think about stuff. And instead of actually getting on with 21st century filmmaking and like connecting with audiences and, you know, taking advantage of this vast direct access to, you know, audiences and whatnot, they are literally doing bean counting or figuratively doing bean counting that smacks of a corporate kind of bureaucratic response and government response circa like 1970. Good luck with it. This is a reason why people don't watch the Oscars anymore or awards programs, because there are always exercises in self-congratulation, and they are where things might have been 30 or 40 years ago. So, yeah, it's immensely telling, and it was, you know, it's in the rearview mirror, I think, and I think that's a good thing.
Zach, you know how to operate a video camera. What do you think about these requirements?
Well, also, you know, I'm in LA. My wife works in the industry as a casting director, so I am somewhat familiar with the, you know, push for representation, which I think is a good thing, actually, in film for people of different backgrounds to see themselves represented in movies and TV. And the way that it's best done is when you have interesting projects that actually, you know, feature people from these diverse backgrounds, and it kind of organically comes together. And there can be, you know, there's certainly, you know, social pressure to create more of those types of projects, which I think is a good thing. But that's really the point to me, is like, these kind of top-down mandates, you know, as Nick is describing, it just feels like kind of like yesterday's approach. You know, the approach that just makes more sense to me is more, you know, bottom up. You create programs that market to certain demographics, you know, acting programs for this demographic, directing, and you develop that talent from the bottom up, and then it bubbles up and you start to see more of it manifest on the screen and in the credits. But this kind of top-down engineering is really nothing more than an attempted shortcut, and I think that it is a step backwards. I know there was a New York Times piece a couple weeks ago calling to end blind auditions for orchestras, which initially was instituted as an anti-racist measure because only all the old white guys in the good old boys club could get into the orchestras because they were well connected. So they put up the blind auditions, and then that increased, made a more diverse representation in orchestras. And now the call is to end that and, you know, keep amping up and ticking all these boxes. And I don't know. It just does strike me as a step backwards at this point.
So this is also paired with last week, the New York Times released a big splashy infographic-y feature, which sorted all of the powerful people in the country, by some definition of powerful, by race and other categories as well. I found it to be a little bit of a creepy exercise on some level. And, you know, I guess you could say, like, well, that's my white privilege talking. But, I, you know, to sort of say, listen, we made a giant grid of faces and highlighted the ones who aren't white people or aren't white men. You know, other times in history, making that giant grid of faces, like, that didn't end well. And so I guess, you know, there's two questions I have about that, Eric, for you. One is, you know, do you think it's different to do that type of process when we're talking about, for instance, the representatives in our representative government? And two, what do we do about the kind of problems of bias and error, even in an exercise like that? I mean, the biggest example that jumped out at me for obvious reasons is that Justin Amash was listed as white. He was not classed with people of color, even though it is no secret at all that he is the son of Syrian and Palestinian immigrants. You know, he has every claim to being a person of color that many of the people of color in that graphic, they were classed. And you got to assume it's because he's a Republican, at least in part, was a Republican, is now a libertarian. Wears a tie. I don't know what the problem is, but there's something weird going on in there. But I guess my question for you, Eric, is like, it's one thing for Hollywood to do it. Is it different when we're talking about government officials?
Well, it's one thing for Hollywood to do it, and it's kind of similar when it's the New York Times doing it, right? Like what happens here is these institutions just sort of end up revealing their own biases in their attempt to be totally objective. And here's just a, you know, graph chart that shows everybody by their racial makeup or what. That's not an accurate way to depict, you know, obviously, somebody like Justin Amash. It's not an accurate way to depict Americans. It's not an accurate way to depict elected officials who, whatever their racial backgrounds or genetic backgrounds might be, they all come to Congress with their own, you know, predisposed biases, with their own experiences from where they grew up in what is a very diverse country. And I think that's probably more important to any member of Congress than you know, where their parents or grandparents were born. It really does. I think this, like, the theme of this whole podcast has been just sort of hearkening back to mid-century understandings of things. And it really does, right? It seems like this is a way we might have understood things in the 1950s. Like, oh, well, you know, we've got the black neighborhood over there and we've got the Hispanic neighborhood over there, and these things are monoliths within the city or something. And that's just not the experience of America anymore. And it seems weird to try to stuff things back into those boxes. And I think when you do see institutions like Hollywood in general, or the Academy, or the New York Times doing this, it ends up just sort of revealing these weird biases that they have. I think it is, to your question, Catherine, just to touch on that, I think it is different when you're talking about government, like, that has a monopoly on the exercise of power. There's maybe some sort of difference there that matters than when a private institution is becoming obsessed with these checkboxes. I don't have a good answer for what that difference necessarily means, but I think there is something to be said for the way in which political power is allocated. And this gets me, we won't go down this road, but this gets me thinking about things like gerrymandering and the way in which congressional districts are drawn, oftentimes to advantage or disadvantage, not just political parties, but even like whole racial groups. And that is a weird kind of behavior that needs reform. Although even just beginning to reform it is a very difficult thing to do. So there are, I think, very serious conversations about the racial makeup of political power in America that we should have and have to have. To me, when it's an institution like the New York Times or Hollywood, like, I'm happy to just let them go do their silly experiment.
Well, and it
well,
hollows
Hollywood
out.
Also has a long history,
sure, yeah,
of
absolutely
creating codes and rules for itself, sometimes to stave off government interference. I mean, everything from, you know, the blacklist
to the rating systems,
the Hays Code, the rating system. Hollywood, perhaps better than most industries, or more than most industries, kind of is famous for making its own rules and using that as a shield against.
But typically, we understand that as a form of repression and of self-censorship, because that's also one of the reasons why there is a parallel history of homosexual readings, of queer readings of major motion pictures and things like that. And I think it's, on a couple of levels, it's worth thinking about when major cultural institutions start doing this type of stuff where they're managing expression in a way that aggregates power in the handful of a few. It's always done in the name of preserving, you know, or expressing the Volk and the cultural zeitgeist and things like that. But that's not how it functions. It aggregates power in very few hands, and it represses the ability of individual creators to kind of follow what they want to do. And I think that, you know, is something we should think about. And the fact that it's being used now for ostensibly progressive left-wing causes, not Hollywood liberal causes as in the 50s. And the biggest backers of the blacklist in the 50s were actually Hollywood liberals. You know, they were more than happy. People like Stanley Kramer were more than happy to blacklist people because they believed in a certain, you know, set of American values. It's happening again with the New York Times. I would love to see, you know, them talk about their readership and the demographic of their readerships, because in their advertising, materials, they brag, as every publication does, about how much money the people who make the New York Times make, you know, and it's overwhelmingly white, like the subscribers, the people who pay for the paper. And why don't they start, you know, keeping their side of the street clean, and figure out a way where they can model the behavior that they're trying to kind of force onto everybody else in society. And just one quick kind of follow-up from, and this is a place where I think a kind of Foucauldian understanding, which is usually identified with the postmodern left, and a libertarian understanding comes to play. Yeah. Foucault talks a lot about in his work and Discipline and Punish and elsewhere about how the invention of statistics, of data, demographic data that was collected and enforced by the state, is a means of social control. And I know, as a journalist, I benefit hugely from all of the data that the government or official sources compile every year and talk about. But we should be talking about these as means of social control, and that it is a technology that is independent of the desiring aims that anybody is using to lever the, you know, to use this power against people. And I think we're in a better world when we actually talk about ways to minimize the amount of power that is centralized in a system. Because it's just, we know from history that if you have this super powerful organization, whether it's the government or a corporation or whatever, and you don't change the structure of that, you just change who's running it, you get equally bad outcomes all of the time. And the libertarian approach, I think, is more like, this is why we want to decentralize power, whether it's cultural power, whether it's economic power, whether it's political power, because massive systems of social control always end up kind of screwing people over and stymieing and repressing society.
So the answer is to boycott the census so that we deny the government's
statistics. You know, I'm more than willing to luxuriate.
I've been hiding from the census workers in my house for a while now.
I'm scared
they're going to get me. I think, like, you know, I'm home all the time. Like, it used to be easy to not fill out the census, but
to show what a winter soldier, I guess I am of that, or a turncoat, is that I get pissed when I don't get selected for the long form census question.
You want the long form?
Even though
I
know that every answer is merely building up a repressed. This is Louis Althusser, a French Marxist. It's building up the repressive state apparatus, which will no doubt be used to screw over not just me, but all of the things that I hold near and dear.
Yeah. I mean, to be clear, I'm a census dodger largely recreationally. It just sort of amuses me to be disobedient in this very small way. But I do, you know, I do think there's something there about, you know, these people showing up and repeatedly knocking on my door and demanding to know information about me. I understand the original purpose of the census, and I get that it's encoded in our very earliest documents and is da 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 da. But also, like, leave me the hell alone, man.
Yeah. And it may be like the moderate reason libertarian approach is just like, fill out the census as sparsely as possible and don't give them, you know, if you don't want, you know, all these conversations around race and ethnicity, skip the race and ethnicity box. Like, just give them the bare minimum.
Yeah, the Constitution says they're allowed to count you, and that's literally it. So that's all they should get to do. Yeah.
Although it did, the Constitution in its earliest iterations did say it's going to count basically three categories: slaves, who were black, whites, and Native Americans, who didn't count.
Yeah.
So, well, I mean, it's always
great
a political
work, as usual.
I mean, and, you know, this is an Enlightenment tool, statistics, really, population statistics, and it is a means of control. I think one of the other things to think about with this, and again, I like pushing it from a kind of left angle, because this is, you know, the horseshoe where libertarians and certain, like, hardcore lefties meet up, is, you know, like what would have happened if the federal government in the mid to late 70s didn't come up with Hispanics as the category that they were going to use to lump together all sorts of people, including some from the Philippines all the way through, you know, Central America and South America, we would be having different conversations, and I think better conversations that would be less about large aggregated groups that have ultimately very little in common other than being drawn in a big circle by the government and then political consequences or ramifications flowing from that, you know, and we'd be having better conversations the more we individualize experience. I think, you know, in the same way when we're in a store, when we're shopping online, you know, an individualized experience is better than just being
Pop-Tarts.
Yeah. Well, now Pop-Tarts are better because there are more of them. You know, people, categories are better. And we can, we're self-inventing. I mean, this is, at the end of the 20th century, it looked like we had escaped using the crudest, dumbest categories to identify people, you know, black, white, Latino, whatever, you know, even male and female. And we're back now 20 years into the 21st century. That's reasserted itself with a vengeance and it's dumbing everything down.
I look forward both major uptick in 23andMe subscriptions in Hollywood. Like, I assume everybody's about to go check real quick and see if they qualify for something, except for the people who already are assumed to qualify, who will definitely not be taking a 23andMe to disprove that. I'm also I'm predicting an uptick in they/them pronouns and some other, because right now our sort of, you know, our views on race are somewhat more empirical. And I think Nick is completely right to point out, like, those categories are broken and weird and archaic in a thousand different ways. But our views on, you know, being other types of minorities allow more individual discretion. And it will be interesting to see if people exercise that discretion. So I want to talk about sports. I mean, I don't want to talk about sports. I hate sports. I don't care about sports. As listeners to this podcast know,
increasingly Americans don't care about sports.
And I am now the median American, I think. But movies are all politics now. Sports are also all politics now. Eric, you wrote this weekend about the NFL's latest anthem controversy, which is not even its only anthem controversy, I suppose. Can you fill us in on that? What's going on? Everybody's
angry. The short version is that the NFL decided that it was going to play, that it was, in addition to playing the national anthem before every game, it was also going to start playing Lift Every Voice and Sing, which is sort of a historical black anthem, has been called, you know, for many years by many different people, the black national anthem. The NAACP calls it such. They were going to play this before the games as a sort of attempt to recognize the Black Lives Matter movement and the significance of all of the things that have happened since the last football season ended in February on the sort of racial front in America, which is all fine and good, I guess. The stadiums are empty. There's no one there. There are a few people there. I guess there are a few stadiums that are allowing a few handfuls of fans in. Nobody's watching the national anthems at home. I mean, any of the people who get worked up on Twitter over the players aren't standing for the national anthem. They're sitting on their couch at home watching the beginnings of football games, or they're going to get beer from the fridge. The whole thing is just so completely overwrought and crazy to me. And so that's why I think in the piece that I wrote for this weekend, I praise the Miami Dolphins, which is a thing that nobody really ever does because it's a terrible team. It has a long history of losing football games. But they did the right thing this weekend. They said their entire team was just going to stay in the locker room for both anthems, for both songs, that they didn't want to be part of this song and dance. And I think that's exactly the right response here. I think more teams should do that. And I think, you know, I don't know whether we continue to play the national anthem or not before sporting events is even debatable in my mind. But I think that's the right approach to all of this. The players want the owners to take sort of more obvious action, political action, and put their money towards, you know, candidates that are going to, you know, make certain reforms or whatever. It's not exactly clear what the players want their owners to do, but there's clearly this tension that is increasing, this politicization that is increasing between players and owners in a bunch of sports, not just the NFL. The NBA had a little kerfluffle about this in a sort of a 2-day long wildcat strike during the playoffs a few weeks ago. And this is a thing we're going to see more of, I think. This is only the beginning of sort of the next stage And I guess just the last point that I would make is we talked a lot on this podcast and a lot in general in society about Colin Kaepernick over the last few years. When he started kneeling for the national anthem and started that whole uproar, he said repeatedly in interviews that the reason he was doing it had nothing to do with the flag, nothing to do with the anthem, that he wanted to start a conversation about racial policing in America. And hey, we're finally there. I hated Colin Kaepernick when he was a player because he played for the team that was often competing with my favorite team for one of the top spots in the NFL. But he was absolutely right. And it took 4 years for the NFL to kind of get there. They shunned him. They basically threw him out of the league. And it's taken a long time to get there. But in the end, we're finally having the conversation that he wanted to have 4 years ago, a conversation that got hijacked by Twitter.
Nick, you love changing the conversation. Did Colin Kaepernick do the right thing?
Yeah, I was a fan of what he did. I thought that's a smart way of you know, using celebrity to actually get people talking in you know, a way that a person believes. And I happen to agree with him in that. Sports is always political. And one thing I don't have a lot of patience for are people who are like, oh, you know, can't we just have this one thing that is free of politics? And I think back, you know, Matt Welch introduced me to this book. I'm a big baseball fan, as is Matt. Jackie Robinson's Baseball Has Done It, his like brilliant 1964 oral history of integrating baseball and comparing that to the failure of American society to integrate since Robinson in the late 40s broke the color barrier in the major leagues. You know, I've written about how the Olympics was only interesting as a global phenomenon when it was a proxy war, when it was politicized by the Cold War, and it was the free world versus the communist world. Since then, the ratings and the participation rates and all of that have gone down because it's not as interesting. So I don't have a problem with politics being heavily politicized, but you know, something like the NFL, they're happy to talk about anything other than the fact that their ratings have been declining for years. It's a sport that is being sunsetted, kind of like boxing, because of the punishment that it deals to the people who play it. When you if you look at high school and little Pop Warner football, the feeder leagues, they're all suffering major losses. Kids don't want to play that anymore. Parents don't want their kids to play that. Those are the larger issues. And there is a massive amount of hypocrisy in something like the NBA, you know, taking a big stand on Black Lives Matter and whatnot. You know, it's a good way, and, you know, I'm sure it's heartfelt, but it's a great way to also change that conversation from the way they were placating the Chinese Communist Party, censoring anybody who, you know, anybody who said anything about like the way China, which is a major market for the NBA, was treating Uyghurs and other people. So we're going to have these arguments all of the time, and I think you can do it smarter or dumber. But the larger issue, and again, to go back to this theme that has emerged of like mid-century cultural, political conversations and powers and the ways we're thinking about things, stuff like the NBA, the Major League Baseball, the NFL, they are fading. They are institutions that are still massive in their money making and things like that, but they are not what they once were. When you look at the World Series, the number of people who watch it, relatively speaking, nobody gives a shit anymore about this stuff. And that's, by the way, is a sign of excellent growth and progress in society. Catherine, I think we might have been talking about this before the podcast actually started, but you know, in the context of why people don't have as many kids, there are so many more alternatives and options out there, and people can watch so many and participate in so many more activities that these lumbering leagues, you know, of, you know, the NFL itself is like a 600-pound lineman who can barely stand under his own weight. They're like brontosauruses. They have to stand in water because after 15 minutes, they're going to collapse. That's where professional sports is heading.
Nick, since we are talking about so many good things to watch and also children, I'm going to do a Matt Welshian segue into our What You Consuming segment. Sure. Because, Nick, you watched Cuties.
I did indeed. And I also asked kind of innocently on Twitter, I said, I wonder what percentage of people who are calling for the censorship or the utter destruction of Cuties and everybody who involved in watching it, much less making it, What percentage have even watched the trailer or the full movie? And I am currently being ratioed like nobody's business, and that will only continue to grow. I watched Cuties, and you know, the Netflix marketing for it, I guess in the idea of like causing a controversy so people take notice of it, was brilliant. But it's a really serious misrepresentation of what the movie is about. And it's actually a really interesting, good, worth watching movie about kind of adolescent sexuality. It's set in France. It deals with a Senegalese immigrant, a young girl who is bouncing back and forth between a world of massive sexual repression in an Islamic community and then a more kind of ridiculously over-sexualized Western kind of kid culture type of thing. It's a good movie, and it's interesting. I don't think that it is exploitative. It is certainly not child pornography. And the reaction in the culture wars, like with football and with everything else, is just, it's so dumb. I mean, I have been thinking a lot over the past year, if not over the past 50 years, of like, why did my grandparents all emigrate from shitty countries to America to be living through the world that I'm living through now? It's just, it's so dumb. And when people like Ted Cruz, you know, actually write the government to start investigating Netflix for trafficking in child pornography, we have gone off the rails as a society in a profound way.
Zach, what are you consuming?
Could I ask Nick one follow-up about Cuties? Just
God help
of
us
the controversy.
If you must.
I'm just curious because I agree that, you know, so the reaction, particularly from people like Ted Cruz, has been awful. One of the criticisms.
And
that
Tulsi Gabbard, actually.
Tulsi
just
Gabbard.
Because it's like everybody's awful.
Yeah, this is clearly not child pornography. And the criticism that I keep seeing, and I have not seen the movie because this criticism does kind of stick with me. Just the idea that putting, you know, these young actresses in that position is itself a problem to film these kind of scenes. What was your reaction thinking on that level?
Yeah,
I don't, you know, there is a
long tradition in cinema of, you know, of reveling in the thing that you are denouncing. And I don't think this gets to that point because, I mean, the dance scenes, you know, and particularly towards the end are revolting because it is an over-sexualization. Yeah. You know, people said that Linda Blair became a drug addict and had a problem because she was in The Exorcist as a young kid and that nobody should go through that. I mean, you can make those kinds of arguments. Nobody was harmed in the filming of this movie, I think, in an irreparable way, and it doesn't cross those lines. You know, there are famous instances, Maria Schneider's recollections of various scenes in Last Tango in Paris, where it seems as if there may have been something very close to a rape committed against her while filming a famous scene. That is, you know, dark and disturbing. I don't think we're in that territory with this. And again, you know, nobody has to watch this movie or anything, but to make a call forward to Tenet, a movie about, you know, moving backwards and forwards through history. You know, I saw Tenet, I saw The New Mutants, and I saw Cuties like in the past 10 days. And it's like Cuties is the most interesting and most absorbing movie. And if anything, and my girlfriend was saying this, it's like in a different world, Cuties would have been canceled because it also participates in a great French tradition of really hating on kind of North Africans and Muslims. In an alternate universe, it would be woke people attacking Cuties for being Islamophobic rather than anything else.
Yeah. Well, okay. So the movie that I wanted to talk about was Coup 53, which is a documentary about the 1953 Iranian coup, which many of our listeners are familiar with, I'm sure. But just to recap, the elected Iranian government and the British government had a dispute over oil, and it resulted in the British intelligence and CIA basically orchestrating a coup, installing the Shah as the new leader, who himself was eventually ousted and replaced with the Islamist Ayatollah, resulting more or less in the Iran we know and see today. And the documentary, we at Reason TV, we actually had the pleasure of speaking with the filmmaker and the editor and co-writer, Walter Murch. The filmmaker was Taghi Amirani. And the style is extremely innovative. A lot of the movie is really about the false narratives that were perpetuated wittingly and unwittingly by the media at the time. And it shows you as the filmmaker deconstructs those and then reconstructs something that's more accurate. I mean, it literally shows him reconstructing, pushing documents together transcripts that have been cut up to piece together something that is more complete and gives you a much better sense of the true extent that British intelligence especially, but also the CIA played in this. I mean, it's really alarming and disturbing, even if you know the basics of the coup. And it's also instructive in showing how and why the birth of covert operation regime change began and how it changed the global political landscape irreparably, and how differently the Middle East might have been if this had never happened. And it's not available on major streamers yet. They're independently distributing it, but it's good enough that I'd recommend just going to their site, which is coup53.com.
And a really cool cameo about halfway through it that we won't spoil for you here, but there's a really cool, not even a cameo, I mean, a major sort of role played by one of the people who they couldn't actually get to be in the documentary because he's no longer alive. So they substitute in someone reading his lines. That's pretty cool. Or reading, you know, from his own notes, his own, you know, testimony of the time. It's a really good documentary.
Eric, what are you consuming this week?
I guess I'll be a little bit less serious, or maybe just sad. But I want to talk about Phoebe Bridgers' recent album, Punisher. It actually came out back in June, but this whole conversation, I was going to talk about something else, but this whole conversation has made me think back to the beginning of COVID and like that moment where we went over the precipice. And the first solo, or the first single for this album came out on the Friday that I was on a train to New York City for what is now in my and my girlfriend's memory, like the last normal weekend where we took a train to New York City and went to a bunch of bars and we talked about, oh yeah, there's this pandemic thing that's happening that might be here. And then the album came out in June, which was obviously a very different place to be in. And it's a very sort of introspective album about disassociation and about relationships and about not even necessarily knowing where you are all the time. There's one song where she's talking about Germany, but then she thinks maybe she's also in Texas and can't, you know, which places we don't think of as being similar, but in her experience as a touring artist kind of are. The libertarian hook on all this is that the best song on the album is called The End Is Here, which is the final song on the album, and a major element of that song was inspired by the SpaceX launch, or a SpaceX launch that she witnessed with some friends in California. And it's about them speculating whether this is a government drone or some sort of alien spaceship, or whether it's the end of the world or what it means. But it's a beautiful, introspective, thoughtful album. And you should also check out her first album, Stranger in the Alps, which is maybe the saddest album made in the last like 5 or 6 years. It's so good.
My What You Consuming is actually, I would say, an example of how it sometimes works out okay when everything is politics, even things that are not politics, which is the novel Asymmetry by Lisa Holliday. It was a big deal when it came out, I don't know, 2018 maybe, and I'm just getting around to it. I definitely dug into it because it is a thinly veiled, maybe thickly veiled, I don't know, tell all of the author's relationship, sexual relationship with Philip Roth, speaking of giants of the 20th century, I suppose. So I sort of came for the gossip about sleeping with creepy old Philip Roth and stayed for the twist, which I am not going to reveal here, but which sort of pivots the novel out of a beautifully written but essentially frivolous zone into something much deeper and more interesting. So I will leave you there with that tantalizing yet utterly useless review. And I hope that you all will join us next week when we offer you more tantalizing yet utterly useless content. Thank you very much to Eric and Zach for joining us as our special guest stars. Thank you, as always, to Nick for our special not guest starring role. And be sure to check out other Reason podcasts, including the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie, which comes out every Wednesday, and our Soho forums, which come out whenever we darn well please. Thanks again for listening.